Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. And today on the show, Senator Mitt Romney's party-defying vote to convict President Donald Trump on the abuse of power charge in the Senate impeachment trial and the fallout from that vote. Also, a Utah polygamist who pleaded guilty in a massive biodiesel fraud scam testifies against another major player in the scheme. And a state senator files to reduce the penalties for polygamy in Utah. And joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Nate Carlisle. Nate, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Roger.
Also in studio with us is Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Thanks to you for being here, Robert.
Hey, good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. And for the third week in a row, I think kind of unsurprisingly, we've got on the phone Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Hi, Tommy, and welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, you are invited to join this conversation with your questions and comments. You can call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255 to offer your questions, comments, and whatever else. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. We are going to begin today with a clip of Utah Republican U.S. Senator Mitt Romney in his speech to the full Senate in advance of the vote on impeachment. There are any number of fragments of the speech we could start with, but I think we'll jump into some of the sentiment that Romney expressed justifying his vote to convict President Donald Trump on the abuse of power charge. Take a listen, and then we'll come back and hear from Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, who knew this announcement was coming in advance.
The grave question the Constitution tasks senators to answer is whether the president committed an act so extreme and egregious that it rises to the level of a high crime and misdemeanor. Yes, he did. The president asked a foreign government to investigate his political rival. The president withheld vital military funds from that government to press it to do so. The president delayed funds for an American ally at war with Russian invaders. The president's purpose was personal and political. Accordingly, the president is guilty of an appalling abuse of public trust.
Okay, so there it is. Thomas Burr, Senator Romney, standing alone on this among Republican senators. And as I said, Romney had tipped his hand to you in advance. What did he say to you about why this was the conclusion that he had reached, Tommy?
I was one of a handful of reporters who Romney's office gave time with before the senator announced. And I walked into it not really knowing what the senator was going to do. Obviously, he was kind of a big question mark, I think, to everyone, including the White House and other Republican senators. I prepared a few questions, assuming, you know, like some of the other senators, Lamar Alexander, Lisa Murkowski, that he was going to tell me that what the president did was wrong, but it wasn't impeachable. And then Romney told me that, no, he was going to vote guilty on the first charge, which is abuse of power, which was interesting. And Romney talked a lot about how, you know, it really weighed on him. He went to bed late. He was up before 4 a.m. for weeks. He thought a lot about, what the right move was. And at the end of the day, he said the evidence, you know, was convincing that the president, you know, did abuse his power, which he said was an egregious assault, you know, on the presidency, that he had no choice, really. He said he'd sworn oaths under, you know, to God to do his duty, and he had to fulfill that, which is interesting because, you know, there really is no upside for Romney doing this in some ways. It didn't matter. There was, the vote was never going to get to 67 to remove the president. So at the end of the day, it mattered to him, though, because he believed his conscience, he had to do it.
You know, he acknowledged even in that announcement that there were likely to be some political implications for his doing this. And I want to get to those. Tommy, though, if you'll humor me, I have one other clip here. This is a little meatier than the last, and it points to how Senator Romney was weighing the evidence in the trial. This is Romney talking about the point of that now famous phone call between President Donald Trump and the president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky. This is a slightly longer clip than the last one, and it features some commentary on former Vice President Joe Biden, and who's now a presidential candidate, and his son. Take a quick listen to this.
The president's counsel also notes that Vice President Biden appeared to have a conflict of interest when he undertook an effort to remove the Ukrainian prosecutor general. If he knew of the exorbitant compensation his son was receiving from a company actually under investigation, the vice president should have recused himself. While ignoring a conflict of interest is not a crime, it is surely very wrong. With regards to Hunter Biden, taking excessive advantage of his father's name is unsavory, but also not a crime. Given that in neither the case of the father nor the son was any evidence presented by the president's counsel that a crime had been committed, the president's insistence that they be investigated by the Ukrainians is hard to explain other than as a political pursuit. There's no question in my mind that were their names not Biden, the president would never have done what he did.
So, Tommy, is it that the House impeachment managers who were, you know, basically operating as prosecuting attorneys in this, is it that they convinced Romney with their case? Is that the sort of short end of why Romney cast this vote?
Yes, essentially. And the senator told me that, you know, he really didn't buy into the arguments coming from the president's team, the White House team, that some of their arguments he thought were just specious, like the idea that it has to be a crime to be a high crime and misdemeanor. When we all know that when, you know, the Constitution was written, there wasn't a federal code of criminal conduct. So that didn't really play into what the senator said was his decision, that the evidence was clear. And just to add a little more, which I found fascinating, is we were all looking at, you know, Senator Romney wanted witnesses to testify. He was one of the, you know, two Republicans to vote to add witnesses. Specifically, he wanted John Bolton, the former national security advisor, to testify. And I think we all thought at that time, oh, wow, he's really looking, you know, for Bolton to come in and say, yes, he did it, and it was a quid pro quo or something like that. But Romney told me actually he was looking for John Bolton to give him the out. He was hoping that John Bolton would come in and testify, create some reasonable doubt in some form, and then Romney wouldn't have to vote his conscience to vote guilty. Of course, Bolton didn't testify, and Romney said he believed the House manager's case, at least on the first article.
A number of most of the Republican senators dismissed the entire impeachment trial as, you know, a sham trial. So it's not like a lot of them were going into this as impartial jurors from the get-go, right? I mean, you don't obey the real, you know, the rules of actual justice when you're going into a kangaroo court, and that was the argument that they were making, a number of them were making, which kind of brings us to the aftermath of this vote, Tommy. In a call after Romney, you know, took this vote, he told reporters, including myself, that he expected a blowback. What has that blowback looked like? A number of shots across the bow fired at Senator Romney, and I suppose we could start with President Donald Trump's response.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there was a lot of blowback. The senator knew it was coming, though he didn't note that he was probably ill-equipped to deal with how, you know, much it was going to be. The President Trump called him, a failed presidential candidate, which was a theme that he used several times going forward. The president's eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., called him a part of a female anatomy, that I won't use that word on the air. There's been a lot of pushback in conservative media. Yesterday, fascinatingly, at the National Prayer Breakfast, after everyone was being told to, you know, love thine enemy and to, you know, treat the enemy better, Trump got up and he said, "I don't like people who use their faith as justification for doing what they know is wrong." There was a clear indication that was a point he was aiming at Romney, who talked about religion and how that, you know, kind of drove his thought process going into the vote. And there have been obviously plenty of others. The Utah legislature is now considering censuring Romney and saying, passing something paying tribute to the president. I can break a little news on your show, if that's okay, Roger.
Please do.
I just talked to, and this story will be up soon in the Salt Lake Tribune, sltrib.com. I just talked to Governor Herbert, who's here in Washington for an event, and I asked him his thoughts on Romney's vote. And Herbert said, you know, I wouldn't have voted that way, but far from it, quote, far for it to be for me to tell somebody else what they should vote with their information. I think it's hard to find fault with anybody who says, this is my moral code, this is what I believe to be true, and vote according to their conscience. Herbert also said he doesn't believe the legislature should censure Romney just because they disagree with his position.
Yeah, and there's two parts of that I want to get to. Censure, there was also the idea of their of a senator running a bill that would allow, or, you know, purportedly allow the legislature to recall a U.S. senator. You know, there's also this part, Tommy, the strange bit of kind of family drama. Romney's niece is the chair of the Republican National Committee, and she has, you know, in previous instances lined up against her uncle. She's basically doing that again after this vote, right?
She is. And I think when I've talked to Ronna Romney McDaniel before, I talked to Senator Romney about this, they're kind of like, you know, do you always agree with your family? I mean, that's kind of how it is. But she weighed in on Twitter and said that she disagrees with her uncle and that she stands with Trump. Not a surprise. That's kind of been her position along the way when Romney has been critical of the president.
Well, DNC chairwoman, I mean, sorry, RNC chairwoman, makes sense. I want to bring in, you know, we want to get to the visit that Romney had here to Utah and some of his comments to legislative leaders. But first, let's bring in Robert Gerke, Salt Lake Tribune news columnist. And Robert, I've got a weird question for you, which was, you know, did you have any inkling as to what Romney was going to do in this vote? And then what did you make of the vote once it happened?
I didn't have any inkling. As Tommy mentioned, it was kind of a mystery right up until hours before. I think if I had to guess, if I would have been guessing before he had made his announcement, I would have probably thought he would have voted against removing the president, because as Tommy mentioned, there's no upside for him to vote the other way. Yes, I mean, it's important that people, you know, vote their conscience, vote their principles, and but at the same time, he knew the risk, he knew the liability, he knew you know, the punishment he was going to take, and did it anyway. So it wouldn't have mattered had he voted no or yes, the outcome was going to be the same. So I would have guessed he was going to vote no, but I was fairly surprised by that he did the contrary.
I mean, the odds were Romney did become the first senator in U.S. history in an impeachment trial who, as a member of the party of the president, broke ranks to vote against the president, which is a sort of convoluted construction there. But, you know, I don't know. What does that mean, that we've always been this partisan and polarized, Robert Gerke? I mean, in U.S. politics, where, where this is the first time that this has happened?
Well, you know, there were some during the Clinton impeachment, there were some Republicans who voted to acquit him. And I'm not quite old enough to remember the Andrew Johnson votes, but but you know, I think yeah, partisanship has always been a thing, and you're always expected to toe the line and support your party's leader. And so it's rare, I think, that you see people cross over and do the opposite. It's also, I think, says something about the priorities that Senator Romney has, that party isn't the number one priority in his value system, and so you see him willing to, you know, and plus let's be honest, Mitt Romney's in a little bit of a different position, right? He doesn't have necessarily further aspirations within the party or politically. Obviously this will make things very uncomfortable for him for the next 4 years, especially if President Trump is reelected. I think that's going to be something to watch. You know, as Tommy mentioned, the president has not been shy, and he's already been out attacking Senator Romney. He said to Senator Lee at the prayer breakfast yesterday, go home and apologize to the people of Utah for me, that they have to deal with Senator Romney. So you can expect that we're going to see a lot more of that for the next week, month, maybe even the rest of the year.
Tommy, do you want to talk about Senator Lee's position on the impeachment of the president? I'm sorry, the acquittal, I guess, of the president of the United States in this Senate impeachment trial?
Sure. And, you know, I think Romney and Senator Lee came at this very differently. Romney said from the outset that he was coming in with an open mind. He called himself a Senator juror. Which is a hard thing to say multiple times in a row, Senator Juror. But Romney was like, you know, I want to look at all the evidence. Senator Mike Lee, meanwhile, said that, you know, he was not coming this with an open mind at all, that he thought it was going to be hard for anyone to be impartial because politics is involved, and that he thought at the end of the day there would be a, you know, great vindication for the president, and that Democrats would be embarrassed. And he seemed pretty happy yesterday at the White House when the president was kind of lauding him and saying, you know, how great he is. And you couldn't find, you know, they're both Republicans, Romney and Lee, but they're kind of very different people, too.
Robert Gerke, do you want to comment on just the contrast in votes between Senator Lee and Mitt Romney? I know that I saw you as a news columnist on Twitter sort of chastising a position of another newspaper
I don't know if we
vote.
Can say their name. The Deseret News wrote an op-ed today, which, keep in mind, the head of the editorial board there is Senator Lee's former chief of staff, but it was praising Senator Lee for taking a stance that was equally as courageous as Senator Romney's. And I bristled at it because, as Tommy mentioned, Senator Lee was saying that the president was innocent before the first witness even testified. He was doing it entirely based on his gut instinct, and it kind of goes contrary to the argument that Senator Lee has made all along about separation of powers and Congress holding the executive branch accountable. He has sanctioned and given his blessing to the president stonewalling congressional investigations, even an impeachment investigation, refusing to comply with subpoenas, refusing to turn over documents, exercising unilateral authority over foreign policy. It goes against everything Senator Lee has argued for since he became a senator, and he made up his mind from day one, and it never wavered from that. None of the evidence was ever going to, sway him. And I think that's irresponsible, and I think that to call that a courageous act to, jettison everything you've believed in, vote your party, and support your president blindly, that's not courage. I mean, it's a profile and courage and cowardice, night and day. You've got two on either side of the coin.
And again, Robert Gerke's a columnist with the Tribune. He gets to say these things. Thomas Burr, reporter there in Washington, did you follow Romney's visit to the Utah State Legislature, the visit to the Capitol here in Utah? And as we said, there are these motions afoot to kind of punish Romney for his vote by some members of the Utah legislature. I don't know. Yeah. Were you following that?
I think if I could.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
I'll field this because I was up there yesterday as well. It sounds like Senator Romney he made a special trip back because he was only here for a few hours, flew in, flew out. Met with legislative leadership. He didn't meet with the entire Republican caucus. He said he'd be back to do that later. The speaker characterized the meeting as tense, that they expressed their disappointment with the senator's vote. We've seen others, Attorney General Reyes and Representative Chris Stewart, expressing their displeasure with it. But it was kind of a signal and extending the olive branch, which apparently kind of got slapped out of his hand a little bit, to try to explain his position. And so he's going to be doing a lot of explaining of his position, I think. It's probably worth noting that Utah Policy Y2 Analytics was out with a new poll today that showed Senator Romney's approval rating dropping by, I believe, 10 points among Republicans, also spiking, not surprisingly, among Democrats since his impeachment vote. So I think, there's still some dust to settle, and we'll see how he rides this out.
What about that, Robert Gerke? What about that idea of a recall of a U.S. senator?
Oh, it's stupid. I mean, sorry, was that too blunt? It's unconstitutional, and legislative attorneys have said it's unconstitutional. The Constitution of the United States is what sets the qualifications and methods for electing members of Congress, and not the states. And this has been tried in other states, and it's been ruled unconstitutional. I think it's a statement bill, to kind of express displeasure, but it's just it's a bad idea, and it's not going to go anywhere. But they're going to, they'll waste some time with it.
There is a bill file to sort of praise the president and thank him for his work on behalf of the state of Utah, and it's filed by both the House leadership and the Senate leadership.
Yeah, there are two of them. There's one that is being filed by Speaker Wilson and President Stuart Adams, and that's basically praising President Trump for his service to the country and his assistance to the state of Utah. Representative Phil Lyman's is more of expressing displeasure with the Romney vote, expressing their support for President Trump, and this This one, frankly, strikes me as Representative Lyman said the other day that when he was talking about it, that he wants to make sure that Utah remains in good graces with the president, so he doesn't, you know, punish the state for something Senator Romney did. And that sounds a little bit like an abusive relationship to me. You've got Utah, you know, trying to make nice with the president to stay at, to avoid the wrath of a mercurial and unpredictable individual. So, but those will be debated, and I suspect, you know, you've got certainly the one that's being sponsored by the president and the speaker. Sure. is likely to pass. But I wouldn't be surprised if all three of them pass in the wake of this.
Okay, which is something that I'm sure the president would point to. Thomas Burr, Tribune Washington bureau chief, in terms of Senator Romney's, I don't know, like working relationships with people back in D.C., does this do anything to that? And then what about, I mean, this is a long ways off, but 4 years from now, you know, his quote unquote vulnerability for reelection, is that something that maybe, how has the voting public responded as well? Robert Gerke talked about this poll. A lot of questions wrapped up into one there. How about the working relationships to start with?
Yeah, there's a few questions. So let me try to tick through them if I remember them all. So I think one, Romney knows he's kind of done with this White House. He knows that he's not going to get any favors from the president anytime soon. And, you know, those times that the president was sitting next to Romney and they're, you know, kind of talking about a cordial relationship, that's over. The president does hold grudges, and Romney's going to be a big one. When it comes to the Senate, I talked to several senators, you know, after the vote and before the vote, and they all kind of assumed Romney was a big question mark, and they weren't surprised. When I talked to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, you know, he was saying he was surprised and he was disappointed. But I specifically asked him, you know, so, you know, how long is Romney going to be in the doghouse? And McConnell's response was, we don't have any doghouses around here. And the most important vote is the next one. So we have to remember that Romney votes 80% with the president's position. So it's not like he's going to join the resistance anytime soon. And to the question about, you know, how this is playing with voters in Utah, I've got a lot of angry emails from residents in the state who are very unhappy with Romney. We can see that going on for a little while, I'm sure. But Romney's not up for re-election if he chooses to run again until 2024. That's a lot of time. That's like a whole new world in politics in that much time. So he doesn't have any fears for the voters. Yeah, he may, you know, not be treated so well at the Utah Republican, you know, Party convention sometime soon. But he knows that he has time to build that relationship back.
2024 will be a presidential election as well. Robert Gerke, maybe a lot will depend on what happens in 2024.
Yeah, that's the point I was just going to make. I think Senator Romney is sort of, you know, been put out on a desert island for a while. But the 2020 election could make a big difference. If President Trump is reelected, 4 years are going to be pretty uncomfortable. If there's a Democrat in the White House, or if the Senate should, you know, change its makeup in some way, probably not change hands, but then it's a whole new ball game. You know, if he 5 or 4 years from now, if Senator Romney is still on the outs with everybody and looking unpopular, he doesn't need this job. I don't think he necessarily wanted to do the job in the first place. And so I wouldn't be surprised if this if he does serve one term and leaves.
Just before we head to a break, Tommy, any final thoughts on you know, the whole impeachment ordeal that you've been covering for a number of months, and then also, you know, what Romney's vote maybe says about the state of Utah? That might be a question for Robert Gerke, but how about just looking back on a moment in history that you've been covering?
You know, it's been a long, long 3 months, whatever it is, 4 months, 10 years, what something seems like. I'm not really sure, but I'm excited to get some sleep. That's what I'm excited for.
Okay. And then, Robert Gerke, any thoughts on just Romney's vote and what it says about, you know, we often talk about the sort of differing mold that Utah represents.
Yeah, I mean, I think as Tommy mentioned, there are some people who are really upset about it. I have seen a lot of social media posts and heard from a lot of people who are surprised and happy about the vote, and giving him a lot of credit for it. So Utah is not, you know, we've seen Trump's numbers rise a little bit, but he's still quite unpopular for a Republican president in this state. And I think One more thing, just politically and in terms of Utah elections, I think this may give somebody like Ben McAdams a little bit of cover. If you remember, Ben McAdams voted for the articles of impeachment in the House. He's taken a lot of heat for that. But now he can say, well, you know, I'm with Mitt Romney. And that's not a bad place for a Democrat to be in when they're running for this in a swing district.
Okay. Thomas Burr there in Washington, I know we need to let you go, but thanks for joining us for the first part of this show and for your coverage this week.
Thank you.
We need to take a quick break. It's time now for our first break in the show. And the next story coming up is a story about, in my opinion, a movie-worthy tale of a Utah-based fraud and the trial of one of the major players that is underway in Salt Lake City right now. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Nate Carlisle and news columnist Robert Gerke. You are listening to our Friday morning news roundup, and we invite you to join us with your questions and comments. The number to call, 801-355-8255, or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Well, Nate Carlisle, you have been following the story of Washakie Renewable Energy and the fraud that that company's founders committed. For some time now, this week you are covering the trial of someone said to be a major player in this fraud scheme. And let's start, before we get there, with the scheme itself. For those listeners who haven't been following this, the sketch version, Nate, is that this was a tax credits scheme. Basically, Washakie, the company, bilking the federal government. Can you explain how that worked, and then we'll jump into this week's trial?
Yeah, first, let me say hello to all my new followers in Belize and Turkey. they are now following my reporting on this trial because
KCPW signal is stretching across the earth.
Okay. I'll explain the Belize and Turkey joke in a moment. But everyone, I think if you watched a jazz game for a chunk of the middle years of the previous decade, you probably saw the ads for Washakie Renewable Energy. They were purportedly making biofuel up in a plant near Plymouth, Utah, in Box Elder County, and then the federal government was giving them a tax credit to supplement the cost of making that biofuel. And the idea of creating a new renewable fuel source on the energy market. The only problem was Washakie made very little biofuel. They actually were buying it, they portrayed as something they made in order to get the tax credit, and they'd sell it. And it was a colossal scam. The prosecutors are saying that Washakie submitted for credits of more than $1 billion. They didn't get all that. Some of it was denied, but they did illegally get $470 million in these tax credits. This was perpetrated by
two brothers, right?
Yeah, Jacob Kingston was the CEO. His brother Isaiah Kingston was the chief financial officer, and then they had family working up there too. And they are members of the Davis County Cooperative Society, which is a polygamous group. So there's that aspect of it, and that's going to come up at this trial. Already has, as a matter of fact.
So okay, there are these two brothers from a well-known polygamous clan here in Utah. They pleaded guilty to this scheme, and they've had, or they're going to have maybe, or the federal government is interested in seizing some of their assets. And we can get to that. This is something we can get to in a little bit. But there's another player in this that we need to introduce. And this is Lev Derman, whose trial you are covering now. He's not there from the beginning of this whole, of when the company launches. How does he come onto the scene for Washakie Renewable Energy?
Yeah, we need to clarify. Lev Derman is the guy actually on trial now here in Salt Lake City. And in testimony yesterday, Jacob Kingston said he thinks Derman actually only came to Utah three times in the course of 5 to 8 years. But that was enough to get him on trial here in federal court in Utah. The fraud was underway before Jacob Kingston met Lev Derman, and Kingston on the stand yesterday told this tremendous story about Lederman coming to Utah for the first time, end of 2011, I think, or started 2012, pardon me, flies on his private jet to Brigham City, Utah. Jacob presents him with a fruit basket and a cowboy hat and shows him around his plant because Dermen has this chain of gas stations in Southern California and might buy some of the biodiesel that Washakie had. And then shows him around the plant, and then Dermen invites Kingston and his wife to go to dinner with them in Seattle. So they all get back on the plane and fly to Seattle. And then as Dermen's ready to fly the couple home to Utah, says, hey, do you like seafood? Takes them to a seafood store and buys them 15 boxes of seafood to take back to Utah.
Wow. Strange beginning to this relationship. And then, you know, at some point, a plan kind of falls into place to defraud the government and the taxpayer because, again, as we said, the Kingston brothers and along with Dermen are, you know, scamming for these tax credits. How does that plan come together, and then how is it implemented?
Well, the Kingstons were already using the tax credit scam before they met Dermen. But what prosecutors contend is that they meet Dermen and then the fraud gets ramped up, that Dermen was the pusher behind really escalating this fraud into the hundreds of millions of dollars instead of, you know, the meager tens of millions of dollars it was before. And this is where we start to get into foreign countries, because Dermen is pushing them to send some of this fuel through Panama to help with the fraud. He's sending money and looking at resources in Belize. And there was testimony, just a touch of it yesterday, about a Belize government minister that they had dinner with. Later in Jacob Kingston's testimony, we're probably going to hear about how some of the money was laundered through Turkey. Kingston did mention on the stand yesterday meeting with Turkish President Erdogan. And so that's why there are actually journalists in the courtroom from Turkey and Belize listening to this testimony, so they can explain to readers back home the government connections to this fraud.
You mentioned Panama too. There's this part of the scheme that I thought was interesting, was sort of sending the biodiesel on a trip and then having it come back home. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So remember, what they're doing is they're taking biofuel and then just changing the paperwork. In some cases, they're literally changing the labeling on the barrels to make it look like it's vegetable oil or the base ingredients of biofuel, so they can allegedly send it back to the plant and make it and turn it into biofuel and then tell the government they made this biofuel. I mean, it's all just paper shuffling to get a tax credit.
Credits,
so
yeah.
At one point, they've got this biofuel, and they want to make it look like they've got customers in Panama, so they ship biofuel to Panama, relabel it as like vegetable oil or something, truck it across the country just to create kind of a paper trail. They skip the Panama Canal because trucking it would create more paperwork, they said, and then they bring it back to Utah, or back to the United States via California, actually. Still labeled as vegetable oil, and then they create another paper trail to make it look like they processed it back into biofuel, when really it was biofuel the whole time, and they're just...
Right, that they sent on a vacation, and then it comes home again, and then they get credits for it leaving and coming back, because it's supposedly this green fuel, if such a thing can be said to exist, biofuel. And then there's a lot of money involved from these credits, hundreds of millions of dollars, as you said. Who is getting that money, and where is it going?
Well, and this is a key point for the defense, that it was only ever Washakie Renewable Energy that submitted the false paperwork to the U.S. government to get the tax credits. Now, once Washakie gets the money, however, they're looking for ways to launder the money. And the government's contention is that Lederman helped them launder the money by telling them where to send the cash, by creating false paper trails at Lederman's gas stations and fuel company in order to help launder the money and show that this phantom biofuel was moving into his gas stations and stuff like that. Yep. The defense, and we're going to hear more from the defense They haven't put on their case yet. They haven't cross-examined Jacob Kinston yet. But they are ready to portray this whole thing as being perpetrated by the Davis County Cooperative Society and Jacob Kinston, and that point out that none of the fraudulent paperwork to the government was written by Levderman or altered by Levderman.
And Levderman, we've just sort of, you know, you touched on the fact that he owned a series of gas stations in California. Who is he? What's his background?
He's 53 years old. He's an Armenian immigrant, came to the U.S. in 1980 at age 14. He's a U.S. citizen, and he's got a colorful history. He's been on trial a couple times before. He's been accused of some tax schemes and fraud involving his gas stations, and was acquitted of those charges, was acquitted of assaulting an undercover cop years ago. He has hired maybe the most all-star lawyer team the state has ever seen. Mark Garagos from Los Angeles, who has represented all kinds of film and
attorney
and
to the stars. Terms.
Yes, Linda Moreno, who's less well known but has also an impressive client list and has represented terror suspects and things like that. And they are tearing into every witness because it's Jacob Kinston is not the only witness. There is other people who've participated in this scheme who have either pled guilty to charges or are testifying in exchange for immunity. And Garagos is walking the jury through every time these folks have ever lied in an effort to discredit them.
Do you know, sort of a weird question, but how Derman found Garagos to become, you know, his lawyer? Like, how did that connection happen? Was it you never know how that sort of thing happens.
I don't know specifically how he hired Garagos, but I mean, Garagos has represented him a few times over the years. I mentioned some of those other criminal problems Derman had, and Garagos represented him in at least some of those as well.
There's this matter. Sorry, there's so many details to this story. There's this matter of $600,000 in cash that Levderman happens to have had on hand. And then tell us about that, Nate.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you ever go to Mexico and come back with pesos you don't know what to do with? Okay, Levderman had that, except it was $600,000 U.S. currency, apparently, or something like that. And he's like, he tells Jacob, hey, I got too much of this cash. I need you to take it and just pay me for it. So he's, according to Jacob Kinston, he gives Jacob Kinston $600,000 cash, flies him on his private jet back to Brigham City with the cash because, you know, I guess you don't want to just, you know, check it through TSA or something. And then before the plane takes off to go back to California, Jacob Kinston and or his brother hands the pilot checks to cover the cash amount. Yeah.
Wait, any idea where the cash came from originally?
No, okay. There was no such testimony to explain that.
Derman, he told Jacob Kinston that he had some connections that could help, you know, Washakie get a pass from law enforcement, meaning he had connections in the government, in the police, among federal officers who could make the whole thing a lot easier for Washakie. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and this is another key point in the government's case, because especially the conspiracy counts. Derman's not actually charged with bribery, but he is charged with some two conspiracy counts, and this is an element of that they're saying Derman portrayed himself as having connections in law enforcement here and abroad and was telling Jacob Kinston that he could offer him protection from the government. And in some cases, it looks like this was somewhat accurate. I mean, one local police officer in California has already pled guilty to some corruption charges. So is an ICE agent in California. And this is why we're going to hear about Belize and Turkey later in the case too, that Derman did have some government connections, the extent to which isn't clear because, you know, obviously him and Jacob have since been arrested. So this is going to be explained later.
So just to get back around to the what, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars that Washakie is bringing in with from this tax credit fraud, the Kinston brothers had a bunch of assets, including a lot of value in property here in Salt Lake City. What's happening to that?
That's being seized by the government. They've already started that process to try to repay the taxpayers for the fraud.
Robert Gerke, news columnist, I don't know how to bring you in on this. It basically sounds like a mob story. Do you have any comments on, you know, this bizarre tale?
Yeah, I mean, it's a heck of a story, and it went on for quite some time. I mean, I remember hearing of Washakie back in, you know, as Nate mentioned, the early 2010s, and you know, I know that they were on the radar of the feds back in like 2014, I think, is when they were first fined for abusing this tax credit system. And then it just spiraled. It's a fascinating story, and it's everyone should follow Nate's coverage of it in the coming weeks.
There's this small but alluring detail, Nate, that I just can't help but ask about. There's this government evidence photo in your story of these luxury cars. What are these cars, and were they part of the laundering scheme?
The government says they were. Yes. One of the government's contentions is that Dermen told Kingston that they were going to launder the money by buying things for each other. So he had Kingston buy him a $1.72 million Bugatti, which I had to look up what it even is. It's a French luxury sports car that costs more than the budget of some municipalities in this state. Dermen bought him a Lamborghini or Porsche. I can't remember at the moment. And again, another car I'm never going to have. But they traded houses too. That Kingston bought Dermen a mansion in I think Huntington Beach, California, and Dermen bought Jacob Kingston a house in Sandy, Utah.
And then there's this. That seems like maybe not a fair trade.
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, no disrespect on Sandy, but yeah. there you go. We didn't get into the Turkish details. There's the possibility that the Kingstons were going to try and maybe flee to Turkey. Is that something that or escape to there?
That's what the government alleged back when they were arrested in 2018, and why they've been held in jails in Utah ever since. That the government feared they were going to flee. All the three main defendants, Jacob and Isaiah Kingston and Lev Dermen, were all going to flee to foreign countries.
There's when does this trial wrap up, and what's in the balance? I mean, what's at stake for Lev Dermen?
Well, Lev Dermen's looking at 180 years, so that's what's at stake for him. This trial, they actually cleared out 8 weeks for it. There was discussion in the courtroom yesterday about how long it's actually going to take. The government thinks it needs three more weeks to put its case on, and then the defense has a chance. So, pitchers and catchers report next week, and this could still be going on when they leave for the regular season.
There's a lot more we could be talking about the structure and history of the Kingstons, or the history of polygamy in Utah and the groups that split off from the LDS Church when it stopped the practice, a long time ago. But short of summing all of that up, what else should we know before we head to a break, Nate Carlisle?
That basically the defense strategy is to make the Kingstons look worse than the defendant, Lev Dermen.
Okay. Follow Nate Carlisle's fascinating coverage of this story at sltrib.com. Let's take another break, and then there is still more to come, though, including, and this is just by chance, the bill at the Utah legislature that would lessen the penalties for practicing polygamy in Utah. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Nate Carlisle and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Weigh in on what you've been hearing by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. And again, this is purely coincidental. We were talking about a polygamous clan wrapped up in a fraud scheme. We'll now turn to a story about a bill at the Utah legislature that would, in some ways, lessen the penalties for polygamy in Utah, but it also has some other provisions that would kind of do the opposite. Maybe Nate Carlisle, tell us about this bill.
Yeah, if folks thought impeachment went on a long time, let me tell you about polygamy in Utah. So there is yet another bill at the state legislature to address polygamy. But unlike bills in previous years, this one is focused on reducing the penalties for otherwise law-abiding polygamists. I used the phrase in the paper the other day, consenting adults who are polygamists. And it would lower the penalty for those folks down to an infraction. If you've ever gotten a traffic ticket, an infraction's probably less than that.
Can I just quickly interrupt you? I mean, you made the distinction between law-abiding, consenting adults, and because there is a sort of history of especially among polygamous communities, of people entering into, well, or being forced into polygamous marriages at an early age.
Yes, and so the bill would keep that scenario a felony, punishable by up to 15 years in prison. Mm-hmm. This is the line that the state senator, Deidre, Henderson, is trying to walk, that she doesn't want to unduly punish or victimize, again, the law-abiding polygamist, but she recognizes there are problems in these communities, and she wants to keep those serious crimes. This has gotten some mixed reaction among the polygamist community. Some folks certainly like the idea. Some folks like the idea of reducing the penalties for the consenting adults, but they would prefer that the criminal penalties be done away with altogether for those folks. People are pointing out too that if you do have a polygamist who's committing fraud or sexual abuse or domestic abuse, there's already crime, laws on the books to address those crimes.
Hmm. Just in terms of the fines itself, the penalties for polygamy or the crime that polygamy represents in the state of Utah, how often is that even prosecuted in any reasonable way?
It hasn't been prosecuted among consenting adults in a couple generations. And Henderson's goal here is to not have it prosecuted at all. I mean, by taking it down to an infraction, she's giving law enforcement no incentive to devote manpower to this issue. She's basically trying to codify prosecutors' current policies of not prosecuting consenting adults who decide to be in polygamy. What she would like, and what a lot of people would like, even a lot of polygamists would like, is the focus to be on people who are committing frauds and abuses.
She has found a co-sponsor in the Senate, V. Lowry Snow, Senator Snow. Is that correct for this bill?
I don't recall who there's supposed to be lots of co-sponsors, and that's another point. She's worked on this for 2 or 3 years, and she's been talking with people in and out of polygamy, people who have left polygamy, and also doing some lobbying among her colleagues to explain this issue and why they might support it. It should be noted that the Utah legislature last amended the polygamy statutes in 2017 to make them what they are now, where it's a felony in any scenario. And the two people who really drove that, Mike Noel and Senator Van Tassel, are no longer in the legislature. So you've got some new blood in there, and they seem to have a different frame of mind about this.
You cover this beat, and you've been covering it for quite a while, the polygamy beat in Utah. Can I ask a very basic question, which is, how many polygamists are there in the state?
That's a tricky question. There is a former plural wife who still considers herself a fundamentalist, who tries to do a survey, and her best estimate has been 30,000, but that's gotten a little trickier in recent years with the diaspora of the FLDS. And
that's the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and they have gone elsewhere.
They've moved all over, since Warren Jeffs was put in prison and the raid in Texas and stuff, and all the things have happened there. There's also, you've got some fundamentalists who kind of like mainstream faiths, they consider themselves polygamist or fundamentalist, but they don't necessarily worship at a church anymore. Hmm. So that gets a little tricky too. And are you counting children of polygamists as well?
Right. Okay.
So it's
complicated question.
Yeah, it's a complicated question. The best number kicked around in the state's 30,000, but that's a pretty rough estimate.
Nate Carlisle, chances of this bill passing, we got to head to our underplayed stories here. So I'll have to cut you short. You're not going to make a prediction.
I can.
Okay, Robert Grigge.
I think there's a good chance it'll pass. As Nate mentioned, I think it's got 19 co-sponsors in the Senate, which obviously is more than the votes it needs. Lowry is a pretty effective legislator, and it's got good support in the House. So I think there's a good chance it'll pass. He also mentioned that you can't take it off the books completely, because Utah's constitution would require both a constitutional amendment and an act of Congress to sanction that. So this is sort of the best they can do at this point.
Okay. I'm sorry that we have to cut you off there, but Nate Carlisle, thanks for your reporting on this for years now. And we have finally come to that point in the show where we need to turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And this is just a story that maybe didn't get the coverage that you think it should have, or that you just want to talk about right now. Nate Carlisle, I'll stick with you. What's your pick for underplayed story?
So this really kind of happened last week, but it's an ongoing story because we still don't know quite what happened. But the Salt Lake City School Board apparently has decided to, what's the soccer phrase, bag or when they get rid of a coach?
Sack.
There we go. Thank you. Bag, sack, whatever. Yeah. The superintendent, the business manager, and I think some other people. And they're just not saying what went on here or why. It's a very opaque situation. And let me also point out that, we really need education reporters for this. And we've got very few of those left in this state. I mean, the Tribune used to have a whole education desk, and now we've got one person who covers all education on like a part-time basis. The Deseret News in a similar fashion. The TV stations don't have anyone. Well, I think one TV station has someone devoted to education. And this is a undercovered topic in the state, and it's going to show up here with whatever the heck this school board decided to do.
So support your local media, donate to the SL Trib and KCPW.
Thank you very much. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story of the week, if that's not it.
Just the other day, I guess this happened yesterday, Fred Adams, who was the founder of the Utah Shakespearean Festival, he founded this festival in 1961. And turned it from this sort of little community project into a nationally recognized, internationally recognized performing arts troupe. Fred died yesterday, but he's left quite a legacy in Southern Utah and in the arts community.
Okay. Remembering a prominent Utahn who has passed, from Robert Gerke, I'll go with a bill on ending straight party voting in Utah that Representative Patrice Arendt is trying to pass in this, her last legislative session. She's retiring after this. She told me that it is a high priority for her this year. You can read all about it in the Salt Lake Tribune. Nate Carlisle and Robert Gerke, both from the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me today on the show.
Thank you, Robert.
All right, that does it for Behind the Headlines, a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, as always, to KCPW's Jesse Ellis and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan. Podcasts are available out there in the ether. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening, and come back again next week.